appeared inside the wheelhouse before Kelly could come up with a rejoinder. There appeared to be someone inside who was not in uniform, which surprised Kelly. A moment later, the cutter's engines rumbled anew, and the 41 boat moved northwest. "Good morning." It was Pam. "What was that?" Kelly turned. She wasn't wearing any more now than when he'd put the blanket on her. But Kelly instantly decided that the only time she'd surprise him again would be when she did something predictable. Her hair was a Medusa-like mass of tangles, and her eyes were unfocused, as though she'd not slept well at all. "Coast Guard. They're looking for a missing boat. How'd you sleep?" "Just fine." She came over to him. Her eyes had a soft, dreamlike quality that seemed strange so early in the morning, but could not have been more attractive to the wide-awake sailor. "Good morning." A kiss, a hug. Pam held her arms aloft and executed something like a pirouette. Kelly grabbed her slender waist and hoisted her aloft. "What do you want for breakfast?" he asked.
"I don't eat breakfast," Pam replied, reaching down for him.
"Oh." Kelly smiled. "Okay." She changed her mind about an hour later. Kelly fixed eggs and bacon on the galley stove, and Pam wolfed it down so speedily that he fixed seconds despite her protests. On further inspection, the girl wasn't merely thin. Some of her ribs were visible. She was undernourished, an observation that prompted yet another unasked question. But whatever the cause, he could remedy it. Once she'd consumed 4 eggs, 8 slices of bacon, and 5 pieces of toast, roughly double Kelly's normal morning intake, it was time for the day to begin properly. He showed her how to work the galley appliances while he saw to recovering the anchors. They got back underway just shy of a lazy 8 o'clock. It promised to be a hot, sunny Saturday. Kelly donned his sunglasses and relaxed in his chair, keeping himself alert with the odd sip from his mug. He maneuvered west, tracing down the edge of the main ship channel to avoid the hundreds of fishing boats he fully expected to sortie from their various harbors today in pursuit of rockfish. "What are those things?" Pam asked, pointing to the floats decorating the water to port. "Floats for crab pots. They're really more like cages. Crabs get in and can't get out. You leave floats so you know where they are." Kelly handed Pam his glasses and pointed to a bay-billed workboat about 3 miles to the east.
"They trap the poor things?"
Kelly laughed. "Pam, the bacon you had for breakfast? The hog didn't commit suicide, did he?" She gave him an impish look.
"Well, no.
Don't get too excited. A crab is just a big aquatic spider, even though it tastes good." Kelly altered course to starboard to clear a red nun boy.
"Seems kind of cruel, though."
"Life can be that way," Kelly said too quickly, and then regretted it. Pam's response was as heartfelt as Kelly's.
"Yeah, I know."
Kelly didn't turn to look at her, only because he stopped himself. There'd been emotional content in her reply, something to remind him that she too had demons. The moment passed quickly, however. She leaned back into the capacious conning chair, leaning against him and making things right again. One last time, Kelly's senses warned him that something was not right at all. "But there were no demons out here, were there?"
"You'd better go below."
"Why?" "Sun's going to be hot today. There's some lotion in the medicine cabinet, main head."
"Head?"
"Bathroom."
"Why is everything different on a boat?"
Kelly laughed. "That's so sailors can be the boss out here. Now shoo. Go get that stuff and put a lot on, or you'll look like a French fry before lunch." Pam made a face.
"I need a shower, too. Is that okay?"
"Good idea," Kelly answered without looking. "No sense scaring the fish away."
"You."
She swatted him on the arm and headed below. "Vanished. Just plain vanished," Oreza growled. He was hunched over a chart table at the Thomas Point Coast Guard station.
"We should have got some air cover, helicopter or something," the civilian observed.
"Wouldn't have mattered, not last night. Hell, the gulls rode that blowout."
"But where'd he go?"
"Beats me. Maybe the storm sank his ass." Oreza glowered at the chart.
You said he was northbound. We covered all these ports, and Max took the western shore. You sure the description of the boat was correct?
Sure.
Hell, we did everything but buy the goddamned boat for him. The civilian was as short-tempered as 28 hours of caffeine-induced wakefulness could explain. Even worse for having been ill on the patrol boat, much to the amusement of the enlisted crew. His stomach felt like it was coated with steel wool.
Maybe it did sink, he concluded gruffly, not believing it for a moment.
Wouldn't that solve your problem? His attempt at levity earned him a growl, and Quartermaster First Class Manuel Areza caught a warning look from the station commander, a gray-haired warrant officer named Paul English.
You know, the man said in a state of exhaustion, I don't think anything is going to solve this problem, but it's my job to try.
Sir, we've all had a long night. My crew is racked out, and unless you have a really good reason to stay up, I suggest you find a bunk and get a few Z's, sir.
The civilian looked up with a tired smile to mute his earlier words.
Petty Officer Areza, smart as you are, you ought to be an officer.
If I'm so smart, how come we missed our friend last night?
That guy we saw around dawn?
Kelly?
Ex-Navy chief. Solid guy.
Kinda young for a chief, isn't he? English asked, looking at a not very good photo the spotlight had made possible.
He was new at the station.
It came along with a Navy Cross, Areza explained.
The civilian looked up.
So, you wouldn't think...
Not a chance in hell.
The civilian shook his head. He paused for a moment, then headed off to the bunk room. They'd be going out again before sunset, and he'd need the sack time.
So, how was it? English asked, after the man left the room.
That guy is shipping a lot of gear, Cap'n.
As a station commander, English was entitled to the title, all the more so that he let Portagee run his boat his way.
Sure as hell he doesn't sleep much.
He's going to be with us for a while, on and off, and I want you to handle it.
Areza tapped the chart with a pencil.
I still say this would be a perfect place to keep watch from, and I know we can trust the guy.
The man says no.
The man ain't no seaman, Mr. English. I don't mind when the guy tells me what to do, but he don't know enough to tell me how to do it.
Areza circled the spot on the chart.
I don't like this.
You don't have to like it, the taller man said. He unfolded his pocket knife and slit the heavy paper to reveal a plastic container of white powder.
A few hours' work and we turn 300,000. Something wrong with that, or am I missing something?
And this is just the start, the third man said.
What do we do with the boat? Asked the man with the scruples.
The tall one looked up from what he was doing.
You get rid of that sail?
Yeah.
Well, we can stash the boat. But probably smarter to scuttle.
Yeah, that's what we'll do.
And Angelo?
All three looked over to where the man was lying, unconscious still, and bleeding.
I guess we scuttle him, too, the tall one observed, without much in the way of emotion.
Right here ought to be fine.
Maybe 2 weeks, there won't be nothing left. Lots of critters out there.
The third one waved outside at the tidal wetlands.
See how easy it is? No boat. No Angelo, no risk, and $300,000.
I mean, how much more do you expect, Eddie?
His friends still ain't gonna like it.
The comment came more from a contrarian disposition than moral conviction.
What friends? Tony asked without looking.
He ratted, didn't he? How many friends does a rat have?
Eddie bent to the logic of the situation and walked over to Angelo's unconscious form. The blood was still pumping out of the many abrasions, and the chest was moving slowly as he tried to breathe. It was time to put an end to that.
Eddie knew it. He'd merely been trying to delay the inevitable.
He pulled a small .22 automatic from his pocket, placed it to the back of Angelo's skull, and fired once. The body spasmed, then went slack. Eddie set his gun aside and dragged the body outside, leaving Henry and his friend to do the important stuff. They'd brought some fish netting, which he wrapped around the body before dumping it in the water behind their small motorboat. A cautious man, Eddie looked around, but there wasn't much danger of intruders here. He motored off until he found a likely spot a few hundred yards off,
then stopped and drifted while he lifted a few concrete blocks from the boat and tied them to the netting. 6 were enough to sink Angelo about 8 feet to the bottom. The water was pretty clear here, and that worried Eddie a little until he saw all the crabs. Angelo would be gone in less than 2 weeks. It was a great improvement over the way they usually did business, something to remember for the future. Disposing of the little sailboat would be harder. He'd have to find a deeper spot, but he had all day to think about it. Kelly altered course to starboard to avoid a gaggle of sports craft. The island was visible now, about 5 miles ahead. Not much to look at, just a low bump on the horizon, not even a tree. But it was his, and it was as private as a man could wish. About the only bad news was the miserable TV reception. Battery Island had a long and undistinguished history. Its current name, more ironic than appropriate, had come in the early 19th century, when some enterprising militiamen had decided to place a small gun battery there to guard a narrow spot in the Chesapeake Bay against the British, who were sailing towards Washington, D.C. to punish the new nation that had been so ill-advised as to challenge the power of the world's foremost navy. One British squadron commander had taken note of a few harmless puffs of smoke on the island, and, probably with more amusement than malice, had taken one ship within gun range and let loose a few salvos from the long guns on his lower deck. The citizen soldiers manning the battery hadn't needed much encouragement to make a run for their rowboats and hustle to the mainland, and shortly thereafter a landing party of Jack Tars and a few Royal Marines had rowed ashore in a pinnace to drive nails into the touch holes, which was what spiking guns meant. After this brief diversion, the British had continued their leisurely sail up the Patuxent River, from which their army had walked to Washington and back, having forced Dolly Madison to evacuate the White House. The British campaign had next headed to Baltimore, where a somewhat different outcome resulted. Battery Island, under reluctant federal ownership, became an embarrassing footnote to a singularly useless war. Without so much as a caretaker to look after the earthen emplacements, weeds overtook the island, and so things had remained for nearly 100 years. With 1917 came America's first real foreign war, and America's Navy, suddenly faced with the U-boat menace, needed a sheltered place to test its guns. Battery Island seemed ideal, only a few steaming hours from Norfolk, and so for several months in the fall of that year, 12 and 14-inch battleship rifles had crashed and thundered, blasting nearly a third of the island below mean low water and greatly annoying the migratory birds, who'd long since realized that no hunters ever shot at them from the place. About the only new thing that happened was the scuttling of over 100 World War I-built cargo ships a few miles to the south, and these, soon overgrown with weeds, rapidly took on the appearance of islands themselves. A new war and new weapons had brought the sleepy island back to life. The nearby naval air station needed a place for pilots to test weapons. The happy coincidence of the location of Battery Island and the scuttled ships from World War I had made for an instant bombing range. As a result, 3 massive concrete observation bunkers were built, from which officers could observe TBFs and SB-2C bombers practicing runs on targets that looked like ship-shaped islands, and pulverizing quite a few of them until one bomb hung on the rack just long enough to obliterate one of the bunkers, thankfully empty. The site of the destroyed bunker had been cleared in the name of tidiness, and the island converted to a rescue station, from which a crash boat might respond to an aircraft accident. That had required building a concrete quay and boathouse and refurbishment of the 2 remaining bunkers. All in all, the island had served the local economy, if not the federal budget, well, until the advent of helicopters made crash boats unnecessary, and the island had been declared surplus. And so the island remained unnoticed on a register of unwanted federal property until Kelly had managed to acquire a lease. Pam leaned back on her blanket as they approached, basting in the warm sun beneath a thick coating of suntan lotion. She didn't have a swimsuit, and wore only a bra and panties. It didn't offend Kelly, but the impropriety of it was vaguely disturbing for no reason that stood up to logical analysis. In any case, his current job was driving his boat. Further contemplation of her body could wait, he told himself about every minute, when his eyes darted that way to make sure she was still there. He eased the wheel farther to the right to pass well clear of a large fishing yacht. He gave Pam another look. She'd slipped the straps of her bra down off her shoulders for a more even tan. Kelly approved. The sound startled both of them. Rapid, short blasts on the fishing boat's diesel horns. Kelly's head scanned all the way around, then centered on the boat that lay 200 yards to port. It was the only thing close enough to be of concern, and also seemed to be the source of the noise. On the flying bridge, a man was waving at him. Kelly turned to port to approach. He took his time bringing Springer alongside. Whoever this guy was, he wasn't much of a boat handler, and when he brought his craft to a halt, 20 feet away, he kept his hand on the throttles. "What's the problem?" Kelly called over the loud hailer. "Lost our props," a swarthy man hollered back. "What do we do?" "Row," Kelly almost replied, but that wasn't very neighborly. He brought his boat closer in to survey the situation. It was a medium-sized fishing cruiser, a fairly recent Hatteras. The man on the bridge was about 5'8", 50-ish, and bare-chested except for a mat of dark hair. A woman was also visible, also rather downcast. "No screws at all?" Kelly asked when they were closer. "I think we hit a sandbar," the man explained, "about half a mile that way." He pointed to a place Kelly kept clear of. "Sure enough, there's one that way. I can give you a tow if you want. You have good enough line for it?" "Yes," the man replied immediately. He went forward to his rope locker. The woman aboard continued to look embarrassed. Kelly maneuvered clear for a moment, observing the other captain, a term his mind applied ironically. He couldn't read charts. He didn't know the proper way of attracting another boat's attention. He didn't even know how to call the Coast Guard. All he'd managed to do was buy a Hatteras yacht, and while that spoke well of his judgment, Kelly figured it had more likely come from a smart salesman. But then the man surprised Kelly. He handled his lines with skill and waved Springer in. Kelly maneuvered his stern in close, then went aft to his well deck to take the towing line, which he secured to the big cleat on the transom. Pam was up and watching now. Kelly hustled back to the flybridge and coaxed his throttle a crack. "Get on your radio," he told the Hatteras owner. "Leave your rudder amidships till I tell you different, okay?" "Got it." "Hope so," Kelly whispered to himself, pushing the throttle levers until the towing line came taut. "What happened to him?" Pam asked. "People forget there's a bottom under this water. You hit it hard enough and you break things." He paused. "You might want to put some more clothes on." Pam giggled and went below. Kelly increased speed carefully to about 4 knots before starting the turn south. He'd done this all before, and grumbled that if he did it one more time, he'd have special stationery printed up for the bills. Kelly brought Springer alongside very slowly, mindful of the boat he was towing. He scurried off the bridge to drop his fenders, then jumped ashore to tie off a pair of spring lines before heading towards the Hatteras. The owner already had his mooring lines set up, and tossed them to Kelly on the quay while he set his fenders. Hauling the boat in a few feet was a good chance to show his muscles to Pam. It only took 5 minutes to get her snugged in, after which Kelly did the same with Springer. "This is yours?" "Sure enough," Kelly replied. "Welcome to my sandbar." "Sam Rosen," the man said, holding his hand out. He'd pulled a shirt on, and while he had a strong grip, Kelly noted that his hands were so soft as to be dainty. "John Kelly." "My wife, Sarah." Kelly laughed. "You must be the navigator." Sarah was short, overweight, and her brown eyes wavered between amusement and embarrassment. "Somebody needs to thank you for your help," she observed in a New York accent. "A law of the sea, ma'am. What went wrong?" The chart shows 6 feet where we struck. This boat only takes 4, and low tide was 5 hours ago, the lady snapped.
She wasn't angry at Kelly, but he was the closest target, and her husband had already heard what she thought. Sandbar. It's been building there from the storms we had last winter, but my charts show less than that. Besides, it's a soft bottom.
Pam came up just then, wearing clothing that was nearly respectable, and Kelly realized he didn't know her last name.
Hi, I'm Pam.
You all want to freshen up? We have all day to look at the problem.
There was general agreement on that point, and Kelly led them off to his home.
What the hell is that? Sam Rosen asked.
That was one of the bunkers that had been built in 1943, 2,000 square feet, with a roof fully 3 feet thick. The entire structure was reinforced concrete and was almost as sturdy as it looked. A second, smaller bunker lay beside it.
This place used to belong to the Navy, Kelly explained, but I lease it now.
Nice dock they built for you, Rosen noted.
Not bad at all, Kelly agreed.
Mind if I ask what you do?
Surgeon, Rosen replied.
Oh, yeah?
That explained the hands.
Professor of surgery, Sarah corrected. But he can't drive a boat worth a damn.
The goddamn charts were off, the professor grumbled as Kelly led them inside. Didn't you hear?
People, that's history now, and lunch and a beer will allow us to consider it in comfort. Kelly surprised himself with his words. Just then his ears caught a sharp crack coming across the water from somewhere to the south. It was funny how sound carried across the water.
What was that? Sam Rosen had sharp ears, too.
Probably some kid taking a muskrat with his .22, Kelly judged.
It's a pretty quiet neighborhood except for that. In the fall it can get a little noisy around dawn, ducks and geese.
I can see the blinds. You hunt?
Not anymore, Kelly replied.
Rosen looked at him with understanding, and Kelly decided to reevaluate him for a second time.
How long?
Long enough.
How'd you know?
Right after I finished residency, I made it to Iwo and Okinawa. Hospital ship.
Kamikaze time?
Rosen nodded.
Yeah, lots of fun. What were you on?
Usually my belly, Kelly answered with a grin.
UDT?
You look like a frogman, Rosen said.
I had to fix a few of those.
Pretty much the same thing, but dumber.
Kelly dialed the combination lock and pulled the heavy steel door open. The inside of the bunker surprised the visitors. When Kelly had taken possession of the place, it had been divided into 3 large, bare rooms by stout concrete walls. But now it looked almost like a house, with painted drywall and rugs. Even the ceiling was covered. The narrow view slits were the only reminder of what it had once been. The furniture and rugs showed the influence of Patricia. But the current state of semi-array was evidence that only a man lived here now. Everything was neatly arranged, but not as a woman would do things. The Rosens also noted that it was the man of the house who led them to the galley and got things out of the old-fashioned refrigerator box, while Pam wandered around a little wide-eyed.
Nice and cool, Sarah observed. Damp in the winter, I bet.
Not as bad as you think.
Kelly pointed to the radiators around the perimeter of the room. Steam heat. This place was built to government specifications. Everything works and everything costs too much.
How do you get a place like this? Sam asked.
A friend helped me get the lease. Surplus government property.
He must be some friend, Sarah said, admiring the built-in refrigerator.
Yes, he is.
Vice Admiral Winslow Holland Maxwell, USN, had his office on the E-ring of the Pentagon. It was an outside office, allowing him a fine view of Washington. And the demonstrators, he noted angrily to himself.
Baby killers, one placard read.
There was even a North Vietnamese flag. The chanting this Saturday morning was distorted by the thick window glass. He could hear the cadence, but not the words, and the former fighter pilot couldn't decide which was more enraging.
Well, that isn't good for you, Dutch.
Don't I know it, Maxwell grumbled. The freedom to do that is one of the things we defend, Rear Admiral Casimir Podolsky pointed out, not quite making that leap of faith, despite his words. It was just a little too much. His son had died over Haiphong in an A-4 strike fighter. The event had made the papers because of the young aviator's parentage, and fully 11 anonymous telephone calls had come in the following week, some just laughing, some asking his tormented wife where the blotter was supposed to be shipped. All those nice, peaceful, sensitive young people. "So, why are you in such a great mood, Kaz?" "This one goes in the wall safe, Dutch." Podolsky handed over a heavy folder. Its edges were bordered in red and white striped tape, and it bore the coded designator, Boxwood Green. "They're going to let us play with it?" That was a surprise. "It took me till 0330, but yes. Just a few of us, though. We have authorization for a complete feasibility study." Admiral Podolsky settled into a deep leather chair and lit up a cigarette. His face was thinner since the death of his son, but the crystal blue eyes burned as bright as ever. "They're going to let us go ahead and do the planning?" Maxwell and Podolsky had worked towards that end for several months, never in any real expectation that they'd be allowed to pursue it. "Who'd ever suspect us?" the Polish-born admiral asked with an ironic look. "They want us to keep it off the books." "Jim Greer, too?" Dutch asked. "Best intel guy I know, unless you're hiding one somewhere." "He just started at CIA, I heard last week," Maxwell warned. "Good. We need a good spy, and his suit's still blue last time I checked." "We're going to make enemies doing this, lots of them." Podolsky gestured out the window and the noise. He hadn't changed all that much since 1944 and USS Essex. "With all those 100 feet away from us, what'll a few more matter?" "How long have you had the boat?" Kelly asked about halfway through his second beer. Lunch was rudimentary, cold cuts and bread supplemented by bottled beer. "We bought it last October, but we've only been running it 2 months," the doctor admitted. "But I took the Power Squadron courses, finished top in my class." He was the sort who finished number one in nearly everything, Kelly figured. "You're a pretty good line handler," he observed, mainly to make the man feel better. "Surgeons are pretty good with knots, too." "You a doc, too, ma'am?" Kelly asked Sarah.
"Pharmacologist. I also teach at Hopkins."
"How long have you and your wife lived here?" Sam asked, and the conversation ground to an awkward halt.
"Oh, we just met," Pam told them artlessly.
Naturally enough, it was Kelly who was the most embarrassed. The two physicians merely accepted the news as a matter of course, but Kelly worried that they'd seen him as a man taking advantage of a young girl. The thoughts associated with his behavior seemed to race in circles around the inside of his skull until he realized that no one else seemed to care all that much. "Let's take a look at that propeller." Kelly stood. "Come on." Rosen followed him out the door. The heat was building outside, and it was best to get things done quickly. The secondary bunker on the island housed Kelly's workshop. He selected a couple of wrenches and wheeled a portable air compressor towards the door. 2 minutes later, he had it sitting next to the doctor's Hatteras and buckled a pair of weight belts around his waist. "Anything I have to do?" Rosen asked. Kelly shook his head as he stripped off his shirt. "Not really. If the compressor quits, I'll know it pretty quick, and I'll only be down 5 feet or so." "I've never done that." Rosen turned his surgeon's eyes to Kelly's torso, spotting 3 separate scars that a really good surgeon might have been skillful enough to conceal. Then he remembered that a combat surgeon didn't always have the time for cosmetic work. "I have, here and there," Kelly told him on the way to the ladder. "I believe it," Rosen said quietly to himself. 4 minutes later, by Rosen's watch, Kelly was climbing back up the ladder. "Found your problem." He set the remains of both props on the concrete dock. "God, what did we hit?" Kelly sat down for a moment to strip off the weights. It was all he could do not to laugh. "Water, Doc. Just water."
"What?
Did you have the boat surveyed before you bought it?"
Sure, the insurance company made me do that. I got the best buy around. He charged me $100.
Oh, yeah? What deficiencies did he give you?
Kelly stood back up and switched the compressor off.
Practically nothing. He said there was something wrong with the sinks, and I had a plumber check it, but they were fine. I guess he had to say something for his money, right?
Sinks?
That's what he told me over the phone. I have the written survey somewhere, but I took the information over the phone.
Zinks, Kelly said, laughing.
Not sinks.
What?
Rosen was angry at not getting the joke.
What destroyed your props was electrolysis. Galvanic reaction. It's caused by having more than one kind of metal in salt water. Corrodes the metal. All the sandbar did was to scuff them off. They were already wrecked.
Didn't the power squadron tell you about that?
Well, yes, but...
But... You just learned something, Dr. Rosen.
Kelly held up the remains of the screw. The metal had the flaked consistency of a soda cracker.
This used to be bronze.
Damn!
The surgeon took the wreckage in his hand and picked off a wafer-like fragment. The surveyor meant for you to replace the zinc anodes on the strut. What they do is to absorb the galvanic energy. You replace them every couple of years, and that protects the screws and rudder by remote control, like. I don't know all the science of it, but I do know the effects, okay? Your rudder needs replacement, too, but it's not an emergency. Sure as hell you need two new screws.
Rosen looked out at the water and swore.
Idiot!
Kelly allowed himself a sympathetic laugh.
Doc, if that's the biggest mistake you make this year, you're a lucky man.
So, what do I do now?
I make a phone call and order you a couple of props.
I'll call a guy I know over in Solomon's, and he'll have somebody run them down here, probably tomorrow.
Kelly gestured.
It's not that big a deal, okay? I want to see your charts, too.
Sure enough, when he checked their dates, they were 5 years old.
You need new ones every year, Doc.
Damn, Rosen said.
Helpful hint? Kelly asked with another smile.
Don't take it so seriously.
Best kind of lesson.
It hurts a little, but not much. You learn and you get on with it.
The doctor relaxed finally, allowing himself a smile.
I suppose you're right, but Sarah'll never let me forget it.
Blame the charts, Kelly suggested.
Will you back me up?
Kelly grinned.
Men have to stick together at times like this.
I think I'm going to like you, Mr. Kelly.
So where the fuck is she? Billy demanded.
How the hell should I know? Rick replied, equally angry, and fearful of what Henry would say when he got back. Both their eyes turned to the woman in the room.
You're her friend, Billy said.
Doris was trembling already, wishing she could run from the room, but there was no safety in that. Her hands were shaking as Billy took the 3 steps to her, and she flinched but didn't evade the slap that landed her on the floor.
Bitch! You better tell me what you know!
I don't know anything, she screamed up at him, feeling the burning spot on her face where she'd been hit. She looked over to Rick for sympathy, but saw no emotion at all on his face.
You know something, and you better tell me right now, Billy said.
He reached down to unbutton her shorts, then removed the belt from his pants.
Get the rest in here, he told Rick.
Doris stood without waiting for the order, nude from the waist down, crying silently, her body shaking with sobs for the pain soon to come, afraid even to cower, knowing she couldn't run. There was no safety for her. The other girls came in slowly, not looking in her direction. She'd known that Pam was going to run, but that was all. And her only satisfaction as she heard the belt whistle through the air was that she would reveal nothing that could hurt her friend. As searing as the pain was, Pam had escaped. Chapter 3 Captivity. After replacing all the diving gear in the machine shop, Kelly took a 2-wheel hand truck out onto the quay to handle the groceries. Rosen insisted on helping. His new screws would arrive by boat the next day, and the surgeon didn't seem in any hurry to take his boat back out.
So, Kelly said, you teach surgery?
8 years now, yeah. Rosen evened up the boxes on the 2-wheeler.
You don't look like a surgeon.
Rosen took the compliment with grace.
We're not all violinists. My father was a bricklayer.
Mine was a fireman.
Kelly started wheeling the groceries towards the bunker.
Speaking of surgeons,
Rosen pointed at Kelly's chest.
Some good ones worked on you. That one looks like it was nasty.
Kelly nearly stopped.
Yeah, I got real careless that time. Not as bad as it looks, though. Just grazed the lung.
Rosen grunted.
So I see. Must have missed your heart by nearly 2 inches. No big deal.
Kelly moved the boxes into the pantry.
Nice to talk to somebody who understands, Doc, he noted, wincing inwardly at the thought, remembering the feel of the bullet when it had spun him around.
Like I said, careless.
How long were you over there?
Total? Maybe 18 months. Depends on if you count the hospital time.
That's a Navy cross you have hanging on the wall. Is that what it's for?
Kelly shook his head.
Well, that was something else. I had to go up north to retrieve somebody, A-6 pilot. I didn't get hurt, but I got sicker in hell. I had some scratches, you know, from thorns and stuff. They got infected as hell from the river water, would you believe? 3 weeks in the hospital from that. It was worse than being shot.
Not a very nice place, is it? Rosen asked as they came back for the last load.
They say there's 100 different kinds of snakes there. 99 are poisonous.
And the other one?
Kelly handed a carton over to the doctor.
That one eats your ass whole.
He laughed.
No, I didn't like it there much.
But that was the job, and I got that pilot out, and the admiral made me a chief and got me a medal.
Come on, I'll show you my baby.
Kelly waved Rosen aboard. The tour took 5 minutes, with the doctor taking note of all the differences. The amenities were there, but not glitzed up. This guy, he saw, was all business, and his charts were all brand new. Kelly fished out another beer from his cooler for the doctor, and another for himself.
What was Okinawa like? Kelly asked with a smile, each man sizing up the other, each liking what he saw.
Rosen shrugged and grunted eloquently.
Tense. We had a lot of work, and the kamikazes seemed to think the Red Cross on the ship made a hell of a nice target.
You were working while they were coming in at you?
Injured people can't wait, Kelly.
Kelly finished his beer.
I'd rather be shooting back.
Let me get Pam's stuff and we can get back in the air conditioning.
He headed aft and picked up her backpack. Rosen was already on the quay, and Kelly tossed the backpack across. Rosen looked too late, missed the catch, and the pack landed on the concrete. Some content spilled out, and from 20 feet away, Kelly immediately saw what was wrong even before the doctor's head turned to look at him. There was a large brown plastic prescription bottle, but without a label. The top had been loose, and from it had spilled a couple of capsules. Some things are instantly clear. Kelly stepped slowly off the boat to the quay. Rosen picked up the container and placed the spilled capsules back in it before snapping down the white plastic top. Then he handed it to Kelly.
I know they're not yours, John.
What are they, Sam?
His voice could not have been more dispassionate.
The trade name is Quaalude, methaqualone. It's a barbiturate, a sedative, a sleeping pill. We use it to get people off into dreamland. Pretty powerful. A little too powerful, in fact. A lot of people think it ought to be taken off the market. No label. It's not a prescription.
Kelly suddenly felt tired and old, and betrayed somehow.
Yeah.
You didn't know?
Sam, we only met not even 24 hours ago. I don't know anything about her.
Rosen stretched and looked around the horizon for a moment.
Okay, now I'm going to start being a doctor, okay? Have you ever done drugs?
No, I hate the goddamn stuff. People die because of it.
Kelly's anger was immediate and vicious, but it wasn't aimed at Sam Rosen. The professor took the outburst calmly. It was his turn to be businesslike.
Settle down. People get hooked on these things. How doesn't matter.
Getting excited doesn't help.
Take a deep breath. Let it out slow.
Kelly did, and managed a smile at the incongruity of the moment.
You sound just like my dad.
Firemen are smart.
He paused.
Okay, your lady friend may have a problem, but she seems like a nice girl, and you seem like a mensch. So do we try and solve the problem or not?
I guess that's up to her, Kelly observed, bitterness creeping into his voice. He felt betrayed. He'd started giving his heart away again, and now he had to face the fact that he might have been giving it to drugs, or what drugs had made of what ought to have been a person. It might all have been a waste of time. Rosen became a little stern.
That's right, it is up to her. But it might be up to you, too, a little. And if you act like an idiot, you won't help her very much.
Kelly was amazed by how rational the man sounded under the circumstances.
You must be a pretty good doc.
I'm one hell of a good doc, Rosen announced. This isn't my field, but Sarah is damned good. It may be you're both lucky. She's not a bad girl, John. Something's bothering her. She's nervous about something, in case you didn't notice.
Well, yes, but...
And some part of Kelly's brain said, see?
But you mainly noticed she's pretty. I was in my 20s once myself, John.
Come on, we may have a little work ahead. He stopped and peered at Kelly.
I'm missing something here. What is it?
I lost a wife less than a year ago.
Kelly explained on for a minute or two.
And you thought that maybe she...
Yeah, I guess so. Stupid, isn't it?
Kelly wondered why he was opening up this way. Why not just let Pam do whatever she wanted? But that wasn't an answer. If he did that, he would just be using her for his selfish needs, discarding her when the bloom came off the rose. For all the reverses his life had taken in the past year, he knew that he couldn't do that, couldn't be one of those men. He caught Rosen looking fixedly at him. Rosen shook his head judiciously.
We all have vulnerabilities. You have training and experience to deal with your problems. She doesn't.
Come on, we have work to do. Rosen took the hand truck in his large, soft hands and wheeled it towards the bunker. The cool air inside was a surprisingly harsh blast of reality. Pam was trying to entertain Sarah, but not succeeding. Perhaps Sarah had written it off to the awkward social situation. But physicians' minds are always at work, and she was starting to apply a professional eye to the person in front of her. When Sam entered the living room, Sarah turned and gave him a look that Kelly was able to understand.
And so, well, I left home when I was 16, Pam was saying, rattling on in a monotonal voice that exposed more than she knew.
Her eyes turned, too, and focused on the backpack Kelly held in his hands. Her voice had a surprisingly brittle character that he'd not noticed before.
Oh, great, I need some of that stuff.
She came over and took the pack from his hands, then headed towards the master bedroom. Kelly and Rosen watched her leave, then Sam handed his wife the plastic container. She needed only one look.
I didn't know, Kelly said, feeling the need to defend himself. I didn't see her take anything.
He thought back, trying to remember times when she had not been in his sight, and concluded that she might have taken pills two or perhaps three times, then realizing what her dreamy eyes had really been after all.
Sarah? Sam asked.
300 milligram. It ought not to be a severe case, but she does need assistance.
Pam came back into the room a few seconds later, telling Kelly that she'd left something on the boat.
Her hands weren't trembling, but only because she was holding them together to keep them still.
It was so clear once you knew what to look for.
She was trying to control herself, and almost succeeding. But Pam wasn't an actress.
Is this it? Kelly asked.
He held the bottle in his hands. His reward for the harsh question was like a well-earned knife in the heart. Pam didn't reply for a few seconds. Her eyes fixed on the brown plastic container, and the first thing Kelly saw was a sudden, hungry expression as though her thoughts were already reaching for the bottle, already picking one or more of the tablets out, already anticipating whatever it was that she got from the damn things, not caring, not even noting that there were others in the room.
Then the shame hit her, the realization that whatever image she had tried to convey to the others was rapidly diminishing. But worst of all, after her eyes swept over Sam and Sarah, they settled on Kelly again, oscillating between his hand and his face. At first, hunger vied with shame, but shame won, and when her eyes locked on his, the expression on her face began as that of a child caught misbehaving. But it and she matured into something else, as she saw that something which might have grown into love was changing over an interval of heartbeats into contempt and disgust. Her breathing changed in a moment, becoming rapid, then irregular as the sobs began, and she realized that the greatest disgust was within her own mind, for even a drug addict must look inward, and doing so through the eyes of others merely added a cruel edge.
"I'm sorry, Kelly. I didn't tell her,"
she tried to say, her body collapsing into itself. Pam seemed to shrink before their eyes as she saw what might have been a chance evaporate, and beyond that dissipating cloud was only despair. Pam turned away, sobbing, unable to face the man she'd begun to love. It was decision time for John Terence Kelly. He could feel betrayed, or he could show the same compassion to her that she had shown to him less than 20 hours before. More than anything else, what decided it was her look to him, the shame so manifest on her face. He could not just stand there. He had to do something, else his own very proud image of himself would dissolve as surely and rapidly as hers. Kelly's eyes filled with tears as well. He went to her and wrapped his arms around her to keep her from falling, cradling her like a child, pulling her head back against his chest, because it was now his time to be strong for her, to set whatever thoughts he had aside for a while, and even the dissonant part of his mind refused to cackle its "I told you so" at this moment, because there was someone hurt in his arms, and this wasn't the time for that. They stood together for a few minutes while the others watched with a mixture of personal unease and professional detachment.
"I've been trying," she said presently. "I really have. But I was so scared."
"It's okay," Kelly told her, not quite catching what she had just said. "You were there for me, and now it's my turn to be here for you."
"But..."
She started sobbing again, and it took a minute or so before she got it out.
"I'm not what you think I am."
Kelly let a smile creep into his voice as he missed the second warning. "You don't know what I think, Pammy. It's okay, really." He'd concentrated so hard on the girl in his arms that he hadn't noticed Sarah Rosen at his side.
"Pam, how about we take a little walk?"
Pam nodded agreement, and Sarah led her outside, leaving Kelly to look at Sam. "You are a mensch," Rosen announced with satisfaction at his earlier diagnosis of the man's character. "Kelly, how close is the nearest town with a pharmacy?"
"Solomon's, I guess. Shouldn't she be in a hospital?"
"I'll let Sarah make the call on that, but I suspect it's not necessary." Kelly looked at the bottle still in his hand. "Well, I'm going to deep six these damn things." "No," Rosen snapped. "I'll take them. They all carry lot numbers. The police can identify the shipment that was diverted. I'll lock them up on my boat." "So what do we do now?"
"We wait a little while."
Sarah and Pam came back in 20 minutes later, holding hands like mother and daughter. Pam's head was up now, though her eyes were still watery. "We got a winner here, folks," Sarah told them. "She's been trying for a month all by herself."
"She says it isn't hard," Pam said.
"We can make it a lot easier," Sarah assured her. She handed a list to her husband. "Find a drugstore. John, get your boat moving, now." "What happens?" Kelly asked, 30 minutes and 5 miles later. Solomon's was already a tan-green line on the northwestern horizon. "The treatment regime is pretty simple, really. We support her with barbiturates and ease her off."
"You give her drugs to get her off drugs?"
"Yep," Rosen nodded. "That's how it's done. It takes time for the body to flush out all the residual material in her tissues.
The body becomes dependent on the stuff, and if you try to wean them off too rapidly, you can get some adverse effects, convulsions, that sort of thing. Occasionally, people die from it.
What? Said Kelly, alarmed.
I don't know anything about this, Sam.
Why should you?
That's our job, Kelly. Sarah doesn't think that's a problem in this case.
Relax, John.
You give... Rosen took the list from his pocket.
Yeah, I thought so. Phenobarb.
You give that to attenuate the withdrawal systems.
Look, you know how to drive a boat, right?
Yep, Kelly said, turning, knowing what came next.
Let us do our job, okay?
The man didn't feel much like sleep, the Coast Guardsmen saw, much to their own displeasure. Before they'd had the chance to recover from the previous day's adventures, he was up again, drinking coffee in the operations room, looking over the charts yet again, using his hand to make circles, which he compared with the memorized course track of the 41 boat. How fast is a sailboat? He asked an annoyed and irritable Quartermaster First Class Manuel Oreza.
That one? Not very. With a fair breeze and calm seas, maybe 5 knots. A little more if the skipper is smart and experienced.
Rule of thumb is 1.3 times the square root waterline length is your hull speed. So for that one, 5 or 6 knots. And he hoped the civilian was duly impressed with that bit of nautical trivia.
It was windy last night, the official noted crossly.
A small boat doesn't go faster on choppy seas. It goes slower. That's because it spends a lot of time going up and down instead of forward.
So how did he get away from you?
He didn't get away from me, okay?
Areza wasn't clear on who this guy was or how senior a position he actually held, but he wouldn't have taken this sort of abuse from a real officer. But a real officer would not have harassed him this way. A real officer would have listened and understood. The petty officer took a deep breath, wishing for once that there was an officer here to explain things. Civilians listened to officers, which said a lot about the intelligence of civilians.
Look, sir, you told me to lay back, didn't you? I told you that we'd lose him in the clutter from the storm, and we did. Those old radars we use aren't worth a damn in bad weather, least not for a dinky little target like a day sailor.
You already said that.
And I'll keep saying it until you figure it out, Areza managed not to say, catching a warning look from Mr. English. Portagee took a deep breath and looked down at the chart.
So where do you think he is?
Hell, the bay ain't that wide. So's you have 2 coastlines to worry about. Most houses have their own little docks. You have all these creeks. If it was me, I'd head up a creek. Better place to hide than a dock, right?
You're telling me he's gone, the civilian observed darkly.
Sure as hell, Areza agreed.
3 months of work went into that.
I can't help that, sir.
The Coast Guardsman paused.
Look, he probably went east rather than west, okay? Better to run before the wind than tack into it. That's the good news. Problem is, a little boat like that, you can haul it out, put it on a trailer. Hell, it could be in Massachusetts by now.
He looked up from the chart.
Oh, that's just what I wanted to hear.
Sir, you want me to lie to you?
3 months!
He just couldn't let go, Areza and English thought at the same time. You had to learn how to do that. Sometimes the sea took something, and you did your best looking and searching, and mostly you found it, but not always. And when you failed, the time came when you had to let the sea claim the prize. Neither man had ever grown to like it, but that was the way things were.
Maybe you can whistle up some helicopter support. The Navy has a bunch of stuff at Pax River, Warrant Officer English pointed out. It would also get the guy out of his station, an objective worthy of considerable effort for all the disruption he was causing to English and his men.
Trying to get rid of me? The man asked with an odd smile.
Excuse me, sir, English responded innocently.
A pity, the warrant officer thought, that the man wasn't a total fool.
Kelly tied back up at his key after 7. He let Sam take the medications ashore while he snapped various covers over his instrument panels and settled his boat down for the night. It had been a quiet return trip from Solomon's.
Sam Rosen was a good man at explaining things, and Kelly a good questioner. What he'd needed to learn, he'd picked up on the way out. And for most of the return trip, he'd been alone with his thoughts, wondering what he would do, how he should act. Those were questions without easy answers, and attending to ship's business didn't help, much as he'd hoped that it would. He even took more time than was necessary checking the mooring lines, doing the same for the surgeon's boat as well before heading inside. The Lockheed DC-130E Hercules cruised well above the low cloud deck, riding smoothly and solidly as it had done for 2,354 hours of logged flight time since leaving the Lockheed plant at Marietta, Georgia, several years earlier. Everything had the appearance of a pleasant flying day. In the roomy front office, the flight crew of four watched the clear air and various instruments as their duties required. The four turboprop engines hummed along with their accustomed reliability, giving the aircraft a steady, high-pitched vibration that transmitted itself through the comfortable high-backed seats and created standing circular ripples in their styrofoam coffee cups. All in all, the atmosphere was one of total normality. But anyone seeing the exterior of the aircraft could tell different. This aircraft belonged to the 99th Strategic Reconnaissance Squadron. Beyond the outer engines on each wing of the Hercules hung additional aircraft. Each of these was a Model 147SC drone. Originally designed to be high-speed targets with the designation Fire B-2, now they bore the informal name Buffalo Hunter. In the rear cargo area of the DC-130E was a second crew, which was now powering up both of the miniature aircraft, having already programmed them for a mission sufficiently secret that none of them actually knew what it was all about. They didn't have to. It was merely a matter of telling the drones what to do and when to do it. The chief technician, a 30-year-old sergeant, was working a bird codenamed Cody 193. His crew station allowed him to turn and look out a small porthole to inspect his bird visually, which he did even though there was no real reason to do so. The sergeant loved the things as a child will love a particularly entertaining toy. He'd worked with the drone program for 10 years, and this particular one he had flown 61 times. That was a record for the area. Cody 193 had a distinguished ancestry. Its manufacturers, Teledyne Ryan of San Diego, California, had built Charles Lindbergh's Spirit of St. Louis, but the company had never quite managed to cash in on that bit of aviation history. Struggling from one small contract to another, it had finally achieved financial stability by making targets. Fighter aircraft had to practice shooting at something. The Firebee drone had begun life as just that, a miniature jet aircraft whose mission was to die gloriously at the hands of a fighter pilot, except that the sergeant had never quite seen things that way. He was a drone controller, and his job, he thought, was to teach those strutting eagles a lesson by flying his bird in such a way as to make their missiles hit nothing more substantial than air. In fact, fighter pilots had learned to curse his name, though Air Force etiquette also required them to buy him a bottle of booze for every miss. Then, a few years earlier, someone had noted that if a Firebee drone was hard for our people to hit, the same might be true of others who fired at aircraft for more serious purposes than the annual William Tell competition. It was also a hell of a lot easier on the crews of low-level reconnaissance aircraft. Cody 193's engine was turning at full power, hanging from its pylon and actually giving the mother aircraft a few knots of free airspeed. The sergeant gave it a final look before turning back to his instruments. 61 small parachute symbols were painted on the left side, just forward of the wing, and with luck, in a few days, he would paint a 62nd. Though he was not clear on the precise nature of this mission, merely beating the competition was reason enough to take the utmost care in preparing his personal toy for the current game. "Be careful, baby," the sergeant breathed as it dropped free. Cody 193 was on its own.
Sarah had a light dinner cooking. Kelly smelled it even before opening the door. Kelly came inside to see Rosen sitting in the living room.